Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm happy to be here. My name is John Edgerton, and I am I have the honor to introduce the first speaker. This won't be hard at all. The title of her remarks is Real Compared to Possum. I'm not sure which is real, whether it's the possum or the other things we eat. But I can tell you for sure that Ronnie Lundy is real. She's the real deal. She's a hillbilly woman. And if you think that's a pejorative term, you better watch it around her. She's a sophisticated lady. She's a critic of music and food and life. She is also an uncritical lover of food, music, and life. She's a writer and an editor. That is not a contradiction in terms in her case. She's a woman of letters, not only of books, but of letters A to Z. She loves words. She's a flower child and a family woman. She is part Corbin, Kentucky, Colonel Sanders, and part Louisville, Kentucky, Mean Streets. She is shuck beans and country ham. She is sacrificial and unselfish survivor. And I'll underscore that last word because if there is a survivor in this room, I present you Ronnie Lundy. She'll also lie to you, so just be warned.
Well, I know most of you know my fundamental religious precept, the one about cornbread. I do have another rule I thought I lived by, which was never follow a kid, a dog, or John Edgerton. I find myself stunned and so happy to be here once again among family. In the poem that Donna read to us, she talked about the almost heroic concept of family and porches, and that is a part of our Appalachian culture, and it is a part of who I am. And I marvel that every year I come to this event, every year but one now, in which I was not here in body, but boy, was I sure here in spirit, and did you all manage to just carry me around on your shoulders. I come here every year thinking how this is truly a family that I had not counted on, and that I'm not sure I deserve, but I am damn happy to have. So thank you all so much for being here. Trying to make it real compared to possum. Come listen to my story about a man named Jed, a poor mountaineer. How'd he keep his family fed? That's the subject that we're going to be studying this weekend. We're going to be talking about the foodways of the Southern Appalachians. We're going to be discussing how it is that people who had so little could make so much out of it. Today I'm going to do something that I normally don't do. I'm going to read to you from other people's work because it's other people who have informed me. But before I do, I want to talk just a little bit about the territory that we're going to cover. Physically, the Southern Appalachians is a geographic region. It extends from Maryland south and east through West Virginia, Virginia, Kentucky, North Carolina, Tennessee, into the foothills of Alabama, Georgia, a little bit of South Carolina. It also encompasses the Ozarks of Arkansas, even though that may not be exactly correct according to a geographer, it certainly is correct in terms of culture and foodways. And it shows up in other places as well. You'll find culturally that it pops up in East Texas, where many of us packed up and traveled. And if any of you are from Dayton, Ohio, or Detroit, Michigan, or any of the other spots where the Southern diaspora, where the hillbilly diaspora traveled to, you will recognize much of what we are going to talk about here. It's not only a geographic and cultural region, it's a cultural region defined by foodways and other ways of life and values, but I will also suggest to you that it is a conceptual region, and a region that we have understood in this country as the other, and we continue to understand as the other. We work a lot in this organization trying to embrace the other, trying to respect the characteristics of other cultures and other people, other races, who encompass our region. But this is an other that is difficult for us to grasp because it is an other of class. Next year, we're going to talk about race, and we're going to be very upfront about that. This year, we are talking about class. We're not going to be heavy duty. I'm not going to beat you over the head after my little hour here. But I want you to keep in the back of your mind that everything that we discuss today goes back to the issue of class in this country and how we have made it necessary to have a lower class or an underclass, and how the Appalachian people have been that class for us since the beginning of our origins in the mountains, since we first moved there and we were characterized as criminals and rowdies and people too ornery to live among other folks. I also want you to travel with me just a little bit and recognize that what we're going to do in this weekend is to exalt Appalachian culture. And I know you're all with me on this ride. I know that everybody in this room is ready to embrace this food and these people and learn and have an experience. But most often, when we exalt Appalachian culture, what we are doing is placing it in the past. We are looking at people from the 18th century who survived with many of their foodways and many of their cultural practices intact into the 20th century and the present time. And what we honor is what they brought with them from the past. I live in Asheville, North Carolina these days. I moved there because I wanted to finally make my home in the mountains that I was born in. That gene is really strong and it drags you back. I love Asheville, North Carolina. I love it in part because of its diversity. It's an amazing town. It still has a very strong mountain culture, and it reveres the mountain culture from its past. Hell, it makes its living on it. We sell culture, mountain culture, like crazy in Asheville, North Carolina. But people who are not from those mountains in Asheville still refer to the folks of the region who are not old, and who are not revered in that way, as the other. The term is no longer, hillbilly is no longer used in Asheville as a pejorative term because, frankly, we have discovered that you can sell it. The pejorative term that is used today in Asheville, North Carolina is redneck. The people from the mountains who have moved to the city to work, who live in the neighborhood that I live in, West Asheville, who drive up and down Patton Avenue on Friday nights in an amazing version of what used to be the promenade in a town square or a corn shucking, but which is now called the Cruise. The two center lanes of this 4-to-6-lane street are occupied by people in cars who at every red light talk to one another across the lanes. Whoever stops across from them, they become friends with and talk. These people are called rednecks, and this particular social activity is denigrated, looked down upon, laughed at, are occasionally sampled as a sort of high-scale slumming. The other term that we use to describe the other these days, which applies not only to my people, but to many people of the South, is white trash. You know, I had an experience here a couple of years ago with one of our own presenters who had made a sort of spurious statement about some Appalachian foodway, which I had, of course, called him on, and raised my hillbilly ire in such a way that he knew already that I was going to smack him if he used hillbilly as a bad term. And he felt perfectly comfortable coming up to me at a meal and saying, you know, I don't like using hillbilly either. There are a lot of people in the mountains who are educated and they're smart. And, you know, I don't want to call them hillbillies, but you know who I'm talking about. I'm talking about those people with the cars in the yard. I'd rather call them poor white trash. We were interrupted. I was not the only person with a bone to pick with this man, and Louis Osteen had to shove some biscuits down his throat. Actually, it was Marlene, of course, as you know. It wouldn't have been Louis. It would have been Marlene going, eat this biscuit and tell me my husband doesn't know how to cook. But we were interrupted, so I didn't have the chance to say to him what I'm going to say to you today. Before you let the words white trash slip from your lips again, which we do constantly in this culture, we've even turned white trash into sort of a hip counterculture thing. Before you say those words ever again, answer this question for me. At what precise income level, what dollar amount, at what level of taste, how many black velvet pictures does it take? How many trailers do you need to own before a human being becomes trash? That is, whether you know it or not, the essential undercurrent, subtle question that we are addressing in this weekend, because we are representing here, bringing to the fore, celebrating, loving, and joyfully acknowledging the brilliance of a group of people who, for the last 200 years, we have allowed ourselves to think of as trash. And if we can recognize now that this is not the case, then I'm telling you that we can also recognize that the people among us that we think of as a class beneath us are not trash either. Okay. They usually only let me talk on Sunday because I have a tendency to preach. We're going to be talking about the who, what, where, when, and how of Appalachian food, and we are also going to be talking about the why. And it's in the why that we find out the truth about people, and we also find out the truth about ourselves. Why do mountain people do things this way? Last night, I was privileged to be cooking with Sarah Lubinsky and the young women of Mississippi University for Women. They prepared food for us last year, and when John T. and I were talking about who should cook for us this year, boy, I had no question. These women are, and men, there are men in this program too. They are brilliant and they are wonderful. We were cooking in the basement of a Baptist church, or not in the basement, in the back room of a Baptist church that apparently is a pretty austere and fundamental church. I'll tell you, I was having to turn shucked beans with a pair of tongs because there wasn't a spoon to cook with. So if the shucked beans aren't just perfect, Bill, that's because the cooking conditions were a little strange. However, they were very much like the conditions that I considered to be a part of Appalachia. We made do. We didn't have lots of equipment. We didn't have Cuisinarts. My mother, when she made coleslaw, shaved it in her hand, finer than you'll ever find a machine could do. That's what we did because we had to, but also because of necessity. We are going to be asking the question, why? Why does it matter? Why does it matter that we should know what this food is about? Well, the first and the easiest answer is this. It's damn good food. It's some of the best food that you're ever going to eat. Appalachian food is slow food before slow food was cool. We did it out of necessity, but we also do it out of desire. And the desire is not just of the palate. I'm going to talk about this a little later, probably not very eloquently, because this is a thought that I'm just turning around in my mind that I found in a wonderful book called From Existence to Essence by Bill Best, who you're going to meet tomorrow in more detail, whose food you're going to eat today, and who is not only a major steward of the land and a keeper of the flame of Appalachian food, but is also a quite brilliant scholar and thinker who has turned his thoughts many times to our culture. And he suggests that we have a connection. Okay, I'm going out on a limb here. And now I've got to tell you what George Ella Lyon, another great Appalachian, says about a limb. She says, when you're out on a limb and you're sawing the joint behind you, it's a scary thing to do, but oh, the view. So here's what I'm doing. I'm going to try to encapsulate an incredible, brilliant, thoughtful book in just a few short terms. Bill Best talks about the way that we have been judged, Appalachians, in terms of a culture of things. The American culture for the past 200 years has been nothing but a culture of things, and we have grown to be more and more a culture of things. And when you look at my culture, Appalachian culture, measured against the culture of things, we don't even get on the chart. We are so far below. We just simply have not valued money. We have not valued acquiring things. We often don't paint our houses because it's not the most important thing we think about. But we do value the porch with almost heroic heart and spirit. That is because the porch is a meeting place. It is a place where we make connection. We make connection with one another on this porch. We string beans because beans with strings taste better than beans without. But we also string beans because in order to do that, we gather with our mothers and our sisters and our neighbors and our children. And we rock and we tell stories and we form a connection with one another. We make shuck beans, which is probably the most labor-intensive food in the history, certainly the most labor-intensive vegetable, I will say that, in the history of foodways, where this is where not only do you string those beans in a quantity, but you sew them up on a thread and you hang them to dry. And 5 pounds of green beans, if any of you have ever strung green beans, consider 5 pounds of green beans that you string, will make you 4 cups of dried shuck beans, enough to feed 8 people. Or as my friend John Edgerton likes to say, a mess, which is an imprecise measurement that equals enough. That is enough for one meal. In mountain culture, we strung beans to make the bulk of our meals for the winter. We do this because it forms a connection between people. We understand that. But it also forms a connection between us and the land. The porch exists as the icon of Appalachian culture precisely because it is outside of the house. And it connects our inner life to the outer world that we inhabit, to the mountains, to the hills, to our garden, to our livestock, to our dogs, to the front yard, to our car that broke down 2 years ago, and we're not taking it anywhere because, by God, we can use those parts, and we will. And guess what? You can also dry shuck beans on the back seat of the car underneath the window. It's much faster that way. We are connected. And what Bill Best says, or I think he said, and he surely will tell me if I get this wrong, is that we are a culture of connection. That is what we have valued in the Mountain South more than anything that we could acquire, more than any status that we might have in community that would set one person above another, because once you start to do that, you diminish the power of connection. We are people who have connected to one another. And those are the connections that we are going to examine here this weekend. Okay, starting with one connection that has to do with the foodway, I'm going to read to you from the Foxfire book. Lord knows which one. I never know. There's a gazillion of them. The Spring Wild Plant Foods that we collected in order to feed ourselves. Most of y'all know that we're going to have country ham. Anybody who's been around for the last 4 years to hear me rattle on knows that we're going to have shuck beans and, by God, cornbread without sugar in it. We're going to have some other foods that you suspect, But most people think that mountain food is made up of ham, cornbread, pinto beans, shuck beans, a few things raised in the garden, and possum. I'm going to read to you what, in fact, showed up on the table in the spring. Sassafras, both bark and leaves, turned into tea, candy, and jelly. Spice bush, tea, and seasoning. The spice bush actually serves, the seeds of the spice bush actually serve as pepper, which is one of the things we didn't buy at the store. We had it from spice bush. Sweet birch, made into tea. You know, now I'm looking at my own handwriting here, and I swear what it says is bear. And it very well may be that sweet birch was used to tend bear, but I'm guessing there's something else here. We'll skip that. Moral mushrooms, fried. Oh, yeah, they're moral in the mountains. They're very righteous mushrooms, not morels, but y'all call them what you want. We ate them fried, stuffed, in an omelet. We had them in pies, and we dried them long before you could buy them in the gourmet store. Asparagus, which was originally a planted plant but became wild and grew across the mountain, along with the beautiful fiddle ferns that taste like asparagus and are even more lovely. Wild onion, meadow onion. They were sautéed, pickled, and fried. Oh, I need to tell you about the asparagus. You might not know this, but the asparagus has a seed, and when you run out of coffee, you can dry the asparagus seed and grind it up and brew it. Ramps, fried, and soups, and eggs, and we made a salad of the leaves. Wild garlic. My mother's favorite memory was of a farm she lived on, a little house she lived on by a river that had a field of wild garlic in the back. She told my dad that they should start stringing up that garlic and sell it in the store, and he said, who would buy it? Once again, my mother was about 45 years ahead of her time. Nettles, made into soup, baked, or greens. Y'all ever picked a nettle? Think about that. Made into soup. How many nettles does it take to make into soup? Dock, sheep sorrel, rhubarb, pigweed, lamb's quarters, poke, purslane, chickweed, peppergrass, garden cress or tongue grass, shepherd's purse, wild radish, wild mustard, white mustard, black mustard, Indian mustard, and charlock, watercress, horseradish, creases, wintercress, spring grass, bittercress, bulbous cress, tooth root, brook lettuce, blue violets. The greens were cooked or used as a salad. The blossoms were sugared or made into jelly or syrup. Milkweed, ground hog plantain, broadleaf plantain, corn salad, chicory, wild lettuce, dandelion, tall coneflower, and wild salad greens. The salad greens, these were not only cooked and eaten on the spot in the spring, but they were gathered to be canned and put up for the winter. Now, we just had to conceptualize how many fresh beans it takes to make a shuck bean. Try to imagine how many wild salad greens you go across the mountains. Try to imagine the terrain that these people went over to find these foods. We're not talking walking out in your backyard. We're not even talking what my mama did up in Detroit during the war, which was to go out to the highway and pick dandelion greens to have a taste of home. We are talking about people who had to climb steep, steep, steep hills up and down over ford streams in order just to find the food that they were going to eat. We are also talking, I'd like to remind you, about people who for the past 200 years have been referred to as lazy and shiftless. Think about it. I'm going to read you a piece now from Gurney Norman, who is the Gurney who Frank's poem was dedicated to, Gurney and Ann. Connections. See, we have them everywhere. Oh, I picked up the wrong book. This is from 100 Years of Appalachian Visions. Just coincidentally, another book by Bill Best. This was with his wife, Irmgard. They gathered stories from people of the Appalachians that talked about their recognition of who they were and what they were. And it's an amazing document to read for its diversity and its power and beauty. This is from Gurney Norman. This is What It Took to Feed Your Family, during World War II in the 1940s in the Appalachian Mountains. Among our folks in Virginia, we live very much in the old-time mountain way. Grandma and Granddad raised nearly all the food we ate, except for store necessities such as salt and coffee. In the summertime, we bought ice in 50-pound blocks at the ice house in Pennington Gap, and having no car, hauled it home in a taxi after church on Sunday. We kept the ice in the cellar wrapped in burlap bags with the milk and butter sitting next to it. All through the war years, Granddad worked regularly at the mines. This is the only sentence Gurney says. I don't want to elaborate too much, but think about for a minute what it means to say Granddad worked regularly at the mines. In his spare time, he helped Grandma with the farm work, which included milking 2 cows twice a day and churning the butter by hand. In the summers, Grandma canned scores of quart and half-gallon jars of vegetables she had raised and fruit she had cultivated. They kept a sizable flock of chickens for eggs and meat. Every Saturday afternoon, Grandma would wring the necks of 2 or 3 big fryers and skin them in preparation for Sunday dinner. In late summer, we cut the corn in the field, 1 stalk at a time by hand, and dried it in fodder shocks. We dug potatoes and stored them in holes in the ground beneath some of the shocks to shield them from the rain. In the fall, Grandma and Granddad slaughtered 1 or 2 big hogs, made sausages, rendered lard, and smoked the hams. Remember, this is in Grandpa's spare time from working in the mines. Grandma and Granddad had built their house and barn and outbuildings by hand without power tools of any kind. Their house was heated by coal fires and grates in 2 rooms and a coal-burning cook stove in the kitchen. The kitchen had running water, gravity-fed from a cistern Granddad and his oldest sons had dug by hand, but there was no other indoor plumbing until after the war. We kids were mostly spectators of the hard work that seemed to go on all around us without end. Now, doesn't that sound familiar? You all know how your kids are spectators of the hard work that goes on all about them. Sitting there in front of the video machine, calling their friends on the phone, hanging out, occasionally loading up the dishwasher, unloading the dishwasher, taking in their clothes. My daughter would smack me. She really did work a lot harder than that, but you know what I mean. These kids were mostly spectators, although they had a few serious chores to do. My own favorite chore was to walk out through the woods to the pasture in the mornings and the evenings and drive in the cows for milking. We kids were expected to bring in coal and kindling at night for the morning fires and to carry out the ashes. We helped Grandma pick berries, string beans, shell peas, hoe corn, thin corn, pick corn, shuck corn, and shell corn for the chickens. We peeled apples, pears, peaches, and tomatoes and chopped up cabbage for kraut and chow chow. We helped with the housework, washed the dishes, waxed the floors, and always, every Monday without fail, worked alongside Grandma on the all-day job of getting out the family wash. Once a year, we helped Grandma make lye soap in a big iron kettle outside the wash house. Some years, when the peach orchard in the new ground was productive, we made big vats of peach butter in the same iron kettle. On leisurely days, we watched Grandma and Granddad do such things as bottom chairs with bark they had stripped from trees. That sounds like leisure time to me. He loved it. Gurney's writing this story not because it breaks his heart or because he was so daggone glad to get away from there. He's writing it because he loved it. Because in those chores, the children had a connection to their family. And the grandparents had a connection to the land and the reality that they lived in. And everyone had a connection to their past. And everyone had a connection to their future. And in a world that values things over connection, this is perceived to be ridiculous. Come listen to my story about a man named Jed, a poor mountaineer, barely kept his family fed. This is what we are told. Jed Clampett could barely make it. Now, before we get to this question, yes, I do find Jed Clampett a heroic hero, and Granny was a charmer. And yes, I get the point that the Beverly Hillbillies always got the better of the Drysdales and the people with the money. That is not the point. The point is that this television show perpetuated a stereotype that we have been told over and over and over again. And the root of this is this. that a life of things is so much more important than a life of connections, that that day when Jed Clampett shot at a possum and he hit an oil well instead, the only logical thing to do, why the only thing he had aspired to do all of his life, was to load everybody into the truck and drive to Beverly Hills, California, and live in a mansion. Well, now he might have. You know, contrary to what you hear about us, about being closed up people, we are actually fairly adventurous, and sometimes we do like to go away from home and see that big swimming pool and that dining room table with the green felt on it. But he wouldn't have stayed there, and he wouldn't have been happy, and he pined for family, and he would have come home, because that's what we do, because a life made of connections is so much more important than a life made of things. And a life in the mountains was, and to some extent continues to be, no, to a great extent continues to be, a life made of connection. Those people out there on Patton Avenue in Asheville, they are making connections in a way that those of us who go to the mall or go to a movie theater or rent a video and sit in our homes will never, ever, ever, ever comprehend. They're talking to other human beings. They're reaching out to other souls because that is their nature. It is very possibly human nature, and that is what this culture tells you to do. I'm going to read one more thing here. Y'all are blessed. I was going to read you a very long passage from Don West. I think it is too long. Okay, John T. says I have time. Do you all want to bear with a really long thing? Okay, good. Let's do this, because you all need to know who Don West is, and I'm betting that you don't. I didn't. I grew up in Kentucky, where this man worked in the coal fields as an organizer and as a preacher and was arrested and was a major force, and I never heard a word about him until I picked up John Edgerton's beautiful, beautiful treatise, Speak Now Against the Day, and not only read about Don West, but saw a picture of him sitting on his Indian Chief motorcycle with those long hillbilly legs and that great hillbilly shock of hair and those eyes that apparently could stop you dead in your tracks, and went, oh, who is this? I have to know more. So I've been on a quest to find out more about Don West, and I'm here to tell you that we're in luck that the University of Chicago Press is going to reprint all of his work in a book that is coming out later this year, I think. And you will have a chance to read what he wrote himself. He's a poet. He's a scholar. He is one of the founders of the Highlander School, an Appalachian institution that, among other things, talked about social progress and was instrumental in the civil rights movement and is in the southern Appalachian Mountains. I'm going to read to you what Don writes about being a Southerner. He's from the mountains of North Georgia, from Hill People. You say you want a poem with its roots in the earth, a poem that finds beauty in the lives of common people, and perhaps a poem that may sometimes show reasons for the heartache and sorrow of the plain folks, and sometimes point the way ahead. I don't blame you. I sort of feel that way too. Maybe it's because of family background. You know, some people go in for that family stuff. I do come from an old Southern family. You've heard that one before, yeah? Well, I don't mean what you think. Mine is a real old Southern family. I'm no sprig off the decadent tree of some bourbon aristocrat blue blood family of the notorious slave master tradition. That's what is usually meant. You know, the professional Southerners who claim to be kind to Negroes, the tuxedo gentlemen, the silk underweared lace dressed ladies coyly peeping from behind scented fans. No, I don't mean that. I'm more Southern than that. My folks were the men who wore jeans pants and the women who wore Lindsay petticoats. Some of us were the first white settlers of Georgia, and some were already settled when the first white folks came. Some Southerners love to boast about their families, and I reckon I do too, a little. At least none of mine ever made his living by driving slaves. There's nary a slave owner up my family tree. The old story that we don't look too closely for finding a horse thief is a commonplace, of course. And indeed, wouldn't it be shameful to find one of our grandpas doing such a petty theft? Who could be proud of a great-granddaddy with ambition no higher than stealing a horse? By God, we're Americans, and we Americans go in for big stuff. Steal a horse? No. But steal a continent? A nation? Steal the lives and labor of thousands? Thousands of black men and women in slavery? Steal a railroad, a bank, $1 million? Oh, boy, now you're talking. This is written, by the way, in the 1940s. Don would have had to raise it to billions of dollars, and we could have had many more countries than just one continent. That's the real class. Those are the ancestors America's blue bloods worship. But steal a horse, heck, a guy might get hanged for that. Okay. This, then, is the limb of my family tree. Do you think I'm telling you about this tree just because it's mine? You're partly right. But the main reason is that to a greater or lesser degree, it represents the great majority of Southern whites. And their real story has never yet been adequately told. Someday, I intend to do it, to tell about these people with rough hands, big feet, and hard bodies, about the real men and women of the South. That old Southern family stuff you've heard so much about, always meaning the aristocrat slave-owning tradition, is worn about as thin as the blood of those families today. Our people, the real Southern mass majority of whites, are the ones the Negroes were taught to call poor white trash. And we, in turn, were taught the hateful N-word. Nice little trick, isn't it? Hitler used it, too. And it is still being used today by the whites from the big houses. In addition to all this, I'm a hillbilly. My folks were mountain people. We lived on Turkey Creek, and what a place that is. Turkey Creek gushes in white little splashes around the foot of Burnt Mountain and down to the Cardeque. Mountain houses are scattered along the banks of Cardeque. Mountain people live there, plain people to whom it's natural to ask a stranger to stay all night. They have lived there for generations, since the first white man pushed through the Tallulah Gorge and others came up from the lowlands to escape the slave system. Indians have also lived on the Cardeque. It was once their hunting grounds, but most of them were rounded up and marched west toward the setting sun. Mountain men and women on Cardeque have gone west, too, in search of opportunity, but some have stayed. The men and women who first settled the mountains of the South were fearless and freedom-loving. In addition to prisoners, many of them were prisoners, by the way. I'm sure you've heard this, that our mountains were settled by convicts sent over here from England. What you may not have heard or understood is that these convicts were people who were placed in jail because they had debt. These are not people who stole a horse, by the way, because you could get hanged for that. These were just people who owed money, and by the wisdom of the judicial system at that time, were placed in jail because that's the best place to earn money to pay people back. All right. These people, in addition to the prisoners, came to escape persecution in the old country. Many of them came to escape religious persecution. My own people on my daddy's side were Quakers who came to the United States because they were persecuted and left the Northeast because of that and eventually ended up down around North Carolina and Virginia, around Mount Airy area, Galax area. If you open the Galax phone book, you'll find about 48 Lundys in there. We stopped being Quakers. We kept Marion out of meeting, and they kept throwing us out. Okay, some of these people came later to the Friendly Mountains seeking a few rocky acres they could till and call their own. They fled from the ever-encroaching wave of slave-holding planters in the lowlands. The poor whites in slavery days found themselves burdened down with slave labor competition. Their lot in many instances was very little better than that of the slave. In the lowlands of the planters, they were considered a blight upon the community. They were pushed off the desirable lands. Left to them were the submarginable, undesirable ridges or swamps. Many therefore fled to the great mountain ranges of North Georgia and other states where freedom of a sort was to be had.
Disease, starvation, and illiteracy were the lot of tens of thousands of these poor whites who were forced to live in the hard, unfertile regions of the South prior to the Civil War. Now, you may have thought, as I once did, that the Old South was divided simply into whites and blacks, slave and master, and that everybody supported slavery from the beginning. I was taught that in school. Perhaps we might forgive Don's schooling because it happened in the 1920s, but I was taught that in school as well in the 1950s. I bet some of your children are being taught that right now. I was taught that from the history books about my own state, but Oglethorpe, who settled Georgia, and the first settlers of Georgia were bitterly opposed to the whole institution of slavery. Here's what Oglethorpe himself wrote in a letter to Granville Sharp, October 13, 1776. "My friends and I settled the colony of Georgia. We determined not to suffer slavery there. But the slave merchants and their adherents occasioned us not only much trouble, but at last got the then government to favor them. We would not suffer slavery to be authorized under our authority. We refused, as trustees, to make a law permitting such a horrid crime." There it is. There were men who indeed did not fit into a system of power and privilege for few, but eventually their opposition was beaten down, though never destroyed. And so they went to the mountains. And there grew up in these southern mountain communities of non-slaveholding farmers scratching a bare livelihood from the stubborn new ground hillside patches. They hated the slave system and the slave masters. Many of them refused to fight for the lost cause in the Civil War. They reasoned, why fight for a system that oppresses us as well as the black slaves? Yes, these were my people. I come from the Devil's Hollow region, close by Turkey Creek, at the foot of Burnt Mountain in North Georgia. I don't mean to suggest, I will not suggest, that the Mountain South is a place of harmony among black and white settlers. I'm terribly sorry that Frank is not with us, because his perspective is powerful and important, and it is a perspective of suffering apartheid among a community of people who suffer apartheid, and it's very important to understand that. But I will also tell you that I'm very proud to be from the Mountain South, to call myself a Southerner from the Mountain South, because there is a liberalism and an acceptance of people there that you don't encounter in other parts of America, not just in the South, but in other parts of the United States. And again, I think that has to do with connection. If we accept it as the culture wanted us to, the concept that black people were inferior to us, then we denied ourselves a connection with other human beings. And if we accepted that breaking of connection, then we also accepted that we were disconnected from the rest of the world as well. I'm going to read one more thing about connection. This is from Muriel Sharp, who wrote in the 1920s a piece called Cabins in the Land. And I guess this is what I want y'all to remember. I will tell you before I read this that everybody else who speaks is not going to be as sober as I am. And I don't intend to be sober very much at all through the rest of this weekend now that my speech is over. I will be demonstrating another fine mountain tradition. I want y'all to have fun. I want you to love this event and the people that are bringing it to you. But I also want you to keep in the back of your mind these thoughts about connection and the thoughts about why we are eating what we're eating, we're learning what we're learning, and we are knowing these people. Just keep that there. Muriel Sharp said, "Life in the mountains is all tangled up into tantalizing patterns. If they could only be figured out. The relationships weave and interweave underground like tree roots."
kindly stopping in, to have a heapin' helpin' of our mountain hospitality, and learn just how it feels to find a possum up a tree.
Great and powerful eyes.
Yes.
Hello.
Oh, here, I want you to have the microphone.
Yes, you do.
Yes, you do. Dale thinks that she can holler a pig home, but she's lost the skill.
I have. I've lost it. This is a footnote to your early point about rednecks. I was doing some airline crossword puzzle a while back, and the clue was bigot. What do you think the answer was?
Redneck.
Yep.
Let me add a footnote to Dale's footnote, by the way, and this is one of those random footnotes that somebody better go check me on and make sure, because you know, we never let a fact get in the way of a good story. But a couple of years ago, the Courier-Journal in Louisville did a survey in the city of racial attitudes in the city. And Louisville is a very class-divided city. It not only has a black section of town, but there is the redneck section of town, which, curiously enough, people from the richer part of town refer to as you know, that section, poor white section of town. It is actually the most culturally diverse neighborhood in Louisville. But what they found in racial attitudes was that as income levels went up, people's prejudice also increased. Their attitudes that other people were different and were lesser increased as their incomes went up, and people at the lower income level were more willing to accept that other people from other cultures were more like them, and also, I'm sure you all know this, are far more generous proportionately in terms of taking care of people who are in trouble. Yes?
Yes, sure.
Oh, y'all ask a lot of questions in the back because John T's going to have to run this, and I just love watching him run.
I'm not a psychiatrist, but don't you think there is just an element in our human nature, and more so maybe in some people than in others, that we have to put ourselves up, we look down on somebody else. And so there's kind of like a pecking order in the chicken, so to speak.
Yes, there is. We seem in our culture to require an other. I think of that perhaps as pathology, perhaps something that we need to overcome. On the other hand, if it's people who put sugar in their cornbread, it is an other, and they're wrong, and we're better than they are. So, yes.
Yes. Is there a question?
Right there, this young lady.
I'm curious about how the phrase got coined, redneck, that kind of thing, because as I'm sitting here thinking about it in my experience, I don't think it came from us. I'm kind of curious, because that was certainly, I am originally from Chicago, and when I moved to Birmingham a couple of years back, I got an education that was unbelievable. I mean, there were things I was being taught and told, I didn't know. I had no idea. And redneck was one of the terms that I'd heard about, and it really, I think it was taught to me. It was not something that was coming from people that sat around the table with me or my family members.
Well, redneck, the etymology of redneck, as I understand it, and if anybody has better information than I do, please offer it.
Can I give a coda to you, too?
Oh, okay, great. Well, I like him. I saw him nod a couple of times when I was talking, so he can talk. or maybe he was shaking his head. I don't know. my understanding of the etymology of redneck is that it comes possibly from one of two sources. One of them is farmers in the field, white farmers in the field, whose necks were burned red. That you could wear a hat, you could have your shirt on, but if you labored in the fields, you ended up with a very, very red neck. Another definition that's been presented to me, and I don't know how accurate this is that the Wobblies wore red kerchiefs, you know, the labor organizers, and that redneck came into use to mean a labor organizer. I don't think that one has as much strength or credibility. Redneck now, of course, what I find fascinating is that if I said to y'all before I spoke, if I said, what's a redneck, people would just, you know, have tons of things to say about it. Somebody with a pickup truck with a gun across the back of it, a Confederate flag flying on a pole out of the rear, and a hat that speaks of some major farm implement on the front of it, likes country music, you know, but not the Dixie Chicks, blah, 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 on and on and on. Let me tell you another quick thing, and y'all are going to get tired of hearing me get up on my high horse, but I was in Asheville when September the 11th occurred, and there was a tremendous amount of flag waving and an enormous amount of let's go to war and, you know, kill these people. And the people that I worked with at that time were almost entirely people from another area who had moved to Asheville, usually from the northeast or California or someplace, and not from that region. And they said repeatedly that they were afraid to go into the redneck areas because the war sentiment would be so strong, and the passions of the people, that people there would be so bigoted against Iraqis, yada, yada, yada. And I had to have my crawl space fixed during this time. I had to have some work done in my crawl space. So I called a man who did handiwork, who came to my house, about my age, from East Tennessee. We got to talking shuck beans right away, bonded right there. So he knew he could trust me. And he started talking about his feelings about war and government and the kind of religious war that we seemed to be embarked on at that time. And he was the most tolerant, liberal, and accepting person that I met in the entire time there. And he fit the description of redneck perfectly, you know? So it just, again, I know it becomes a cliche. You know, I know that I'm a walking cliche sometimes about look beneath the surface, but you have to do that. You have to understand that.
Ronnie, there may actually be a new term on the horizon with the political and religious climate of the South in the last couple of years, and that's free will primitive Baptist.
Free will primitive Baptist. Yeah, I think actually you're right about that, and I find that pretty interesting. I also am astonished by my peers from other places in Asheville who are constantly referring to the people in the mountains as Baptist. You know, oh, they're Baptist. I mean, well, I guess Billy Graham has his big emporium up from us, so I guess that's where this comes from. Oh, is he Presbyterian? See? There you go. Once again, she didn't look beneath the surface. But the religious culture of the Mountain South is incredibly diverse, and in fact, I would probably say that pantheist shows up a lot of times for us. Many people were not even in churches when I was growing up. There's a gentleman with a microphone. For God's sake, stop me before I sin again.
I'm just curious if I'm the only one that associates redneck with more of the lowlands than Appalachia. I don't know if there's any connection there, but when I think of hillbillies, you know, I think more of Appalachia. And I'm also wondering, have you ever heard the term Covites?
No, what's a Covite?
Covite, C-O-V-E-I-T-E-S. It's a term that sort of has a a connection to the University of the South, people from Tracy City or Covites?
What does a Covite mean?
Come out of the coast.
Covites. Oh, okay. Covites. Okay. That's like Ridge Runner.
Yeah.
Or, yeah. I thought Redneck had a geographic specificity until I moved to Asheville. And I have also discovered that with my daughter's generation, Redneck now just means any poor white person and is applied. Hillbilly has become a hip term. And I personally want to take responsibility for that. So hillbilly has become people who play mountain music and people who know how to do great wood carving and a certain cult. But we have only managed to take off a little piece of the culture and deify that and say that the rest of it is still the other, that redneck is still the other, that bigot is still, the definition of bigot is redneck. Yeah, when I got my laptop a couple of years ago, you know, it had the word corrector thing on it, you know, and I'm writing around and I wrote hillbilly, you know, I was writing something, I wrote hillbilly, and it goes, bing, you know, you can't say hillbilly, and I go, well, what can you say? Two terms for hillbilly, mountaineer and moonshiner. There you got it. More questions?
Yes. I have a question. I grew up in Middlesboro, Kentucky, and I was reared by a fine group of mountain cooks, all of whom know how to fry chicken and make shucked beans and fried apple pies and you name it. But they have the whole group, and me too, really, a strange fondness for things like Velveeta and Jell-O and Cool Whip and things that food people really look down on.
Yes, they
and
do.
And I'm wondering, can you account for this?
Can I account for it? Yes, I can. Let me refer you to the previous readings as Gurney Norman described what his grandfather did in his spare time from the mines, what his grandmother did just to get a meal on the table. My mother loved Cool Whip. I tell you what, Cool Whip came out and our mixer went away.
Right.
We never whipped another thing of whipped cream. And my mother also, you know, we were urban, we were progressive, we were modern, she wasn't on the farm. She cooked from the morning she got up, from the minute she got up until that night just to feed us. She cooked in a kitchen that had no air conditioning. She cooked in a kitchen that was about as big as this podium, if I remember correctly, and we managed to have a table in there that we ate around. She cooked constantly to prepare this food, and when these foods came out, they were a godsend, you know. Now you can ask about the Velveeta cheese. You know, we didn't eat a lot of cheese in the mountains. We're not. There are now artisanal cheese makers all across the mountains, and God love them. They're great, and you know, more power to them. But we weren't doing that. So to have a block of cheese, think about it. You could have a block of cheese that you could eat on, and you didn't have to, after you went to church on Sunday, drive over to the ice house, load up blocks of ice into a taxi you were paying for to drive home and keep it cold. These foods were important, you know? And I'm here to tell you that if you have spent 8 hours on a pontoon boat with all your cousins shoving you off and you having to swim back again in the Laurel River, there's nothing as good as a can of Vianney sausages and a pack of crackers. Millie, hang on. The chair recognizes the lady with the pink hat.
Thank you, Ronnie. The part of the answer to the Jell-O food is because when Jell-O first came out, it was only for very wealthy people. You had to have a refrigerator to make it.
Oh.
And so when people would come into town to places like the Francis Virginia Tea Room and have a gelatin salad, it was a very elegant food.
Well, that's...
So when
you're in the mountains,
and you're able to make Jell-O after lugging the ice in, it shows you have a refrigerator,
right,
which you left on your front porch.
Right. Because the electricity didn't come into your house, not because we were too lazy to take the refrigerator inside. More questions?
I have a question, or kind of a comment, on the, you were talking about hillbilly as a cult. I live in Athens, and I noticed this with the college kids nowadays. I was downtown, and the Christmas parade was coming around, and all the kids now are in trucks. They're listening to Alabama, and I mean, I'm wondering if it's kind of when I was growing up, you know, you wanted to get away from that, and now I'm wondering if it's kind of reverting back. What
yes,
do you think?
It is, and it's a complicated thing. You know, it's like you guys should have been privy to mine and John T's discussion about appropriate music for this event. You know, it's like where the queen of rock and roll turns up her little nose and says, "No, I don't think they're authentic hillbillies. We'll have to get some authentic ones in there." No, it's like, but it has become a very stylish thing, and that is a double-edged sword. You know, it is. I actually made a comment which I have regretted very much. It showed up in print, and I couldn't believe that I said it a couple of years ago here, where I was saying, you know, at least with black culture, you guys are hip. People want to be, you know, cool and black. Well, you know, I mean, what a stupid thing to say. But on top of that, now it has come true for us. It has become pretty hip to be a hillbilly. My daughter and all of her friends meet once a year in Louisville, Kentucky to go to the Shepherdsville Music Hall to see Ralph Stanley play. Now, you have to understand that this is a child that got drugged to every bluegrass festival in the history of the universe and thought that she would die if she ever had to listen to Bill Monroe and Ralph Stanley again, you know? And now it has become a very cool thing. I am thrilled for Ralph Stanley. I am thrilled for everybody on the soundtrack. I am thrilled that our culture means that food from the mountains is becoming hip, so that my daughter and her friends who want to raise food and stay in the mountains where they feel a connection can do so. But it's also very, very bittersweet, because it is another caricature. It is another definition from the outside of who we are. And that has been, from a psychological level, that has been the handicap of being a mountain person. You need to be able to define who you are. We have not been able to do it in the face of what the culture has given us. Frank.
Yeah, hi, I was just thinking, you were talking about, you've learned, hillbillies have learned to market themselves. But what you market is a product, and I've wanted you to riff on a little more. What does it mean when life becomes a product? And if, what the ambivalence is that you might express.
Well, you know what? Referring back to the theme of this morning's conversation, it means, first of all, that you lose connection. You know, Frank is from Eastern Kentucky and other points around the globe, and you're going to hear him speak later, but in Eastern Kentucky, in Pikeville, there's a very controversial celebration. It happens in many places, but Pikeville's the one I know the best, most about, called Hillbilly Days, in which everybody dresses up like Al Capp's version of hillbillies and does the little Abner thing and carries on. And there has been this incredible existential conversation argument that's been going on for the past 15 years of the people of that community and not of that community about, why do we do this and what does it mean about how we perceive ourselves? Are we just having a good time? Are we just having fun? Are we making, you know, are we sending up the people who sent up us? Are we turning this to our advantage? We're making some, why should we let Hollywood make all the money off of the Beverly Hillbillies? Why don't we make some in our own community? But ultimately, I think what the loss is a sense of ownership of who you are and the ability to define yourself according to your reality. That reality becomes more pervasive. Well, you want to say something back? Come on. Yes. Yes. Yes, I think that you do. And I mean, that is a good question. I'm not sure that there is a choice, except for the choice of trying to make it real compared to Possum, which is that as you knowingly participate in this and you do this, you keep referring yourself back to what is real and what you know for fact, what you know to be true. You know, I have talked here about the tendency to characterize mountain people in the negative stereotypes. I have to be very careful myself about a tendency to overcompensate for that and to speak of us only as noble and forthright and resourceful and deeply loving people. That's not the entire picture of what the mountains is by any extreme. We're human beings. You know, we are a human culture. It is incredibly diverse, and it has dark stories as well as joyful ones. Gentleman with his hand. Oh, wait a minute. The lady has the microphone, and then she'll give it to you.
Did the culture of connection extend to people outside that group, or was it more protective than expansive?
Well, that, you know, this is an interesting question that I'm just beginning to explore, because one of the pervasive, it's a gentleman up here, he's wearing a sort of beige windbreaker, it looks like. One of the commonly held wisdoms about the Mountain South is that we were isolated. You know, we were completely isolated. And I just thought my family was peculiar. You know, that we had other contacts. You know, my dad in the 1930s had a little nightclub in Corbin, Kentucky, and Cab Calloway played there, and it was like one of the most exciting things, you know, in his life. But it wasn't like weird. There was a train that went through. People came through on the trains. There were, God knows, from the minute that anything of value was discovered in the South, we were infiltrated by outsiders. Now, my understanding is that we were very open to people, that we embraced these people until we got burned so many times. Is this answering your question? And I think that there became a wariness and perhaps more of a closeness, but... Right, we got burned. But I will tell you this, if you'll indulge me one more second to rattle on, that if you went to the mountains right now and you needed something, or you know, if your car broke down, or if you lost your wallet, and somebody, probably the first person that you met from the mountains would offer to feed you and perhaps to put you up for the night. You know, it is how the culture is. It's how I was raised. And yeah, there's some weird people. I mean, I'm sure that James Dickey had met all those people in Deliverance personally. I'm kind of sure he was related to them. But, but your chances of encountering a psychotic pig lover are, other than in a culinary sense, are far slimmer than finding somebody who would welcome you into their home. Gentlemen.
Ronnie, I grew up on a small farm outside of Jonesboro, Georgia, and raised by a great aunt. And further on in my life, I went to school at Tallulah Falls. But in our lives, in those times, our focus was so different than what we're talking about sometimes and as we relate back. We lived locally. I mean, we lived right there in that little circle. And my brother and I never thought about why, when we got off the school bus, we had to walk back and wait for the black school bus to show up so we could play ball on the hill. We worked together, we played together, we depended all on each other, and we were treated by the same doctor. Dr. Farrell Sams from Fayetteville, Georgia, was my family doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And he treated everybody who lived in that area that we lived on a small family farm.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess we had a localness and a dependency on each other in order to get those things into the hopper. We canned peaches. We canned beans. We did all of those things that you talked about in a little further north. But our focus and our concentration was on getting through the winter, because we didn't have an electric lights until I was 8 years old. And I'm not that old, but I was raised by a great aunt. And so I felt like that her thinking and the world that I lived in was a generation actually before me. So it was very much fun as I look back on it, just how valuable that childhood was for me on that farm.
Absolutely. Part of my understanding of this comes from a once removed experience of that. I grew up in Louisville, as many of you know, part of the hillbilly diaspora. But my family went home to Corbin, and then to my great aunts and uncles lived farther out in the community. So it was an experience of having one foot in one culture and one foot in another, which was very, very informative. But I want to say that what you described, again, is connection. What you valued in that community was not who owned what, but how you could connect it so you could all survive as a community again. And that seems to be the theme here. It's all connected.
Ronnie, I was thinking about the Velveeta yes? question earlier.
And you're using it in your kitchen these days because you have discovered it is the ingredient of the 2000s.
It's on the cheese card, actually.
Very good.
But, I was thinking about this, the commercialization, even James Beard, that's how he started, was, pushing commercial products like that, canned green beans and tomatoes. And, these things got into the West Virginia home ec classes that my mother went to. And the next thing that becomes comfort food,
Mm-hmm.
Ruth Reichel may be apples, but I was potted meat and mayonnaise on toast.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's how
I knew that we had a bond that was deep. I will say this, and a Dixie loaf on white bread with mayonnaise, but it had to be really good mayonnaise, There's John T, I have a woman up here and you have somebody back there.
All right, I'll take your woman first.
All right. A southern gentleman.
Thank you. I'm an East Tennessee, and so I'm a mountain person too. And mm-hmm. thank you for your wonderful talk.
Oh.
And I think one back to the Velveeta, and I know some of you know Spam, and but I don't know how many of you remember margarine that came white in a bag, and you pushed the little button and made it part of what we. Eight was wartime, and there were many things rationed, from sugar to gasoline to bubble gum.
Mm-hmm.
They said they put it in cheese pies. The bubble gum.
The bubble gum.
That's what went. But I was thinking also what you were talking about, people being closed, our reputation for that. And I was an interpreter in France for 3 years. And that thing of people being closed is not really, I think it's something of class to say, oh, mountain people are just closed up, because France is closed up unless you have entree, unless the family, if somebody in the family or a friend recommends you to certain group, then it's open. And then if they don't, well, then it's bonjour, madame, and pass on, And so I think this may be a universal thing.
Mm-hmm.
That people protect themselves in different ways. It's mm-hmm. even been done in Boston, I believe.
Mm-hmm. I think it is true that people protect themselves, although I think that the Mountain South has been has not protected itself to some extent and has invited people in who have misinterpreted. Jerry.
Yeah, hi, Ronnie. I'm from Louisville, and recently I've had the wonderful experience of reconnecting with my mountain and Piedmont Carolina roots. Pleasure. I was down to Asheville for the...
A great and powerful
eye. I'm going to tell you right now what Jerry's saying.
Just be closer. Yeah.
As
I was saying, I live in Louisville, Kentucky, and I've known Ronnie for some time, but I'm originally from the mountains of North Carolina. And recently had a chance to become reacquainted with all that she's talking about, with connection, et cetera. We've been down there several times, most recently with the event we had this summer at the Biltmore. And where I'm leading with all this is connection that you might have experienced in that area or anywhere in the mountains that ties to humor. I was just there this past weekend for a family reunion, visiting with some cousins who live in Asheville. And we're talking about my grandfather and how he was a wonderful, not a pool shark, but a checker shark. And one of his ways of really suckering a stranger in was to talk about how poor he was and how he didn't have anything to eat. And I was reminded of this one story he always talked about. All we've got to eat is jam and grits. And he'd have the person feeling so sorry for him. And he'd say, yeah, we just jam our feet under the table and grit our teeth. So I just wonder if you have any observations in terms of humor as far as how the mountain people might use that to connect to people and to start building relationships, because that's exactly how he did it.
Well, I don't know about you. I actually worried before coming in here because I didn't think what I was going to tell you was funny enough, and it wasn't going to reflect the culture very well. There's always the humor of the oppressed, where you're on the other side of it. But mountain people just did have extraordinary senses of humor and very often self-deprecating, which people absurdly took as literal, you know. And sometimes like Jerry's story, a little bit to pull the strings of strangers who were coming in with assumptions. But I think it's one of the great graces. I grew up in a family where people sat around and told stories and laughed so hard that we drooled. I shouldn't admit that, but I do think it's a great saving grace. It's beautiful.
We have time for one more question.
Well, you talk about closed communities and white trash and all that. I'm from the coast of Mississippi, but I went to school here, and my daughter's here now. Well, she called me, I guess, her first year here within a few months, and she was like, "Oh my God, Mother, I can't stay here." I'm like, "Watch this. Everybody I meet from the Delta calls me coast trash." And I said, "Sweetheart, I was there 30 years ago. Everybody from the Delta calls everybody from the coast white trash. I mean, coast trash. Don't worry about it. The only difference is my daddy told me we drink our liquor in the public and they drank their liquor in the closet." So.
The only difference between you and me is we made our liquor.
I said, "Just don't worry about it." She's like, "Oh, okay."
Okay. May I speak about the food?
You may, please. That was what I
wanted
to do.
Oh, okay, good. We read each other's minds now. Okay, I'm going to speak very briefly about the food we're going to go eat. These folks have been cooking like maniacs, and you know, we always come here and we're always hungry. We have to send out for pizza. Today what we're going to have are shucked beans. And this is an amazingly rare thing to have happen. I want you all to consider again what I just told you about shucked beans. 5 pounds, 4 cups, 8 people. There's 220 of us here. Bill Best shucked these beans for us. Irmgard, I bet you helped, did you? All right. This man grew these beans. He didn't just go buy them. He grew these beans, and you're going to have heirloom varieties that would have been lost, you know, to the world if it were not for Bill Best in these shucked beans. And he strung them, and he dried them, not by stringing them up, but in a greenhouse. And when he didn't have a car big enough. When I called him, I called him up and said, "You know, I'm going to need some shucked beans. Can you get some for me?" Then I called him up and said, "Did you remember about those shucked beans?" Because it was 3 nights before they were supposed to be here. And he said, yes, he had made them all. I had to argue with him about whether or not he was giving us the shucked beans or Southern Foodways was going to purchase them from him. And when I won that particular argument, he then insisted on bringing us tomatoes. So we will be having fresh mountain tomatoes, a gift from Mr. Best, who is probably as well known as a tomato man as a bean man. Now, the sad and sorry part of this story is that he had to trust the cooking of the beans to me. And I, frankly, have never cooked shucked beans in a quantity of this size. I've never seen this many shucked beans. I went in and looked in that pot, and I looked up and said, "Mama, Aunt Ray, Aunt Johnny, Minnie, look down here at these shucked beans I've got." They were thrilled. But they did tell me I may not have done such a great job. The beans are delicate. The beans have, there's a hearty bean itself, and then the shuck that has been dried and reconstituted is around it, and it imparts a very delicate flavor to it. When I was growing up, we only salted. We didn't put pepper in, but there will be pepper on the table that you all can use. You can, and you may need to add salt. I wanted to err on the side of not enough salt than too much, because I just wanted you to have the right experience here. So you may need to add salt. It is not only okay, it is appropriate to crumble your cornbread into the beans and to smoosh it around. And I don't know that we have raw onion. I can't believe that we might not. But there's plenty of onion in the potato salad and the deviled eggs. And you all are to go out there and just make absolute pigs of yourself. And Bill Best is that nice gentleman with the white hair back there.